This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Halfway between two census cycles, states are in the middle of a dry season when it comes to redrawing political districts. In New Hampshire, like in most states, it's a process controlled by the legislature. And so whichever party is in power gets to determine the lines. Critics say that this leads to gerrymandering, giving an unfair advantage to that party come election day, while others say these fears are way overblown. Now, a handful of states are currently looking at whether to adjust the redistricting process. In New Hampshire this year, a bill to establish an independent commission to draw the lines was proposed, but voted down. Today in The Exchange, rethinking redistricting, including new analysis from the NHPR State of Democracy team of 30 years of state Senate maps and data. Let's hear from you this hour. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Dan Barrick, Senior Policy and Politics Editor at NHPR. We'll be talking about Dan's State of Democracy team analysis of that state Senate data. To see the results, you can go to nhpr.org. Dan, lots of work. We really appreciate you coming in.
Thank you, Laura.
Also with us, Rob Boatwright, Associate Professor of Political Science at Clark University. Rob teaches courses on American political behavior, political parties, campaigns, and elections. And Rob Boatwright, welcome to you, too. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Well, gerrymandering, Rob, has kind of a nasty connotation. How do you define it?
Well, there's no precise definition for the term. States get a lot of latitude in drawing legislative districts. For the most part, the only requirement is that they be equal in terms of population. So there's no right and wrong way to draw them. Generally, people use the term gerrymandering when they are displeased about the consequences or feel that particular populations have been disenfranchised somehow.
What does the Constitution, Rob, say about the drawing of districts? And just as important, what doesn't it say?
The Constitution, again, establishes very few rules about how congressional districts ought to look, other than to say that it's under the purview of the states. The Supreme Court ruled back in the 1960s that districts must be equal in terms of population. And the Supreme Court has also mandated in a series of decisions that where there is a protected minority group, they must be given proper representation, which is usually taken to mean that where you have a population of African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans that is sufficiently geographically concentrated that you could create a district where they're in the majority, you must do so. Other than that, there are no national restrictions. Some states place restrictions on, for instance, whether towns can be divided up or other types of things like that.
And districts have to be contiguous, right? I mean, you can't
districts have to be contiguous.
Yeah.
Yes, I forgot that.
Towns have to be next to each other, at least touch each other, even if they have nothing in common, or even if that touching, Rob, right, you know, extends across a state or up and down a state, is a long, thin line or is a funny shape. What are some of the more egregious examples of gerrymandering that you've seen over the years, Rob? I mean, it's radio, so you'll have to describe it, but
right.
What do these districts look like?
I think the two examples that are most commonly given as an example of absurd states, North Carolina was required in the 1990s to draw two districts that were majority African-American, or were at least likely to elect an African-American candidate. At the same time, Democrats controlled the state legislature, so an effort in a southern racially polarized state to help Democrats and create African-American districts can lead to substantial complications. So one of the North Carolina districts linked to African-American populations in Greensboro, Charlotte, and Durham, it did so by using a highway interstate, right? So the joke was that you could drive down the road with your door open and you'd be in two different districts. A more recent example, the state of Ohio, in redrawing its district, Republican legislators sought to combine two heavily Democratic areas in the cities of Cleveland and Toledo. They did so by using a strip of land along the Lake Erie beachfront. This is what is called duck contiguity. That is, you can't necessarily walk from one spot in the district, but you could swim from one spot in the district to the next.
Oh, my gosh. They were contiguous by water.
Yes.
Well, and Rob, people mostly think of this type of activity in terms of congressional districts. How common is it with state House and Senate districts?
Well, it's quite common with it's probably more common with state legislative districts, partially because the stakes are higher for the people drawing the districts. That is, state legislators in most states are given the authority to draw districts. So while they may seek to aid their fellow members of the U.S. House of Representatives, ultimately it's not their problem if these people lose. But if you're looking to protect your own district or protect the legislative majority that you're part of, you will care a lot more about getting things right. So on the one hand, you have smaller populations in these districts, so they don't tend to look as egregious when you look at them on the map just because they're smaller. But legislators, I think, put a lot more effort into helping themselves or their colleagues.
Well, and Dan Barrick, this gets into what you and the State of Democracy team did. You looked at the state Senate here in New Hampshire. What was the question you were trying to answer, Dan?
Well, it started with, you mentioned at the top, the effort this year in the New Hampshire legislature to put together a commission that would take the redistricting process out of the hands of lawmakers, as Rob said, and put it in, you know, create an independent commission that would make it, in theory, nonpartisan. NHPR reporter, stumbled upon the bill, Natasha Haverty. The bill actually ended up going nowhere. The commission was rejected. But it raised, when in this kind of during the proposal, you hear all kinds of claims about the biased nature of redistricting, how it leads to essentially undemocratic outcomes. So it sort of raised a question for us: is there really a problem here? And if so, how could we measure it? Because you hear, these anecdotes about efforts to pack, Democrats into the district to minimize their political power. But given how important redistricting is as really the fundamental political force, it draws these lines that can shape majorities in the House and Senate and then the agendas that come from that. We really wanted to try and understand, is there a way to measure the fairness of the outcomes of the redistricting process? So as I said, we spent a lot of time sort of sifting through anecdotes about what districts are fair or what not, what aren't. As Rob said, in a lot of states, it's driven in some ways by race and the correlations between race and voting patterns. In New Hampshire, that's really not a case given our relatively low non-white populations. So how could we get at this? And we tried a few different ways, and we stumbled upon this relatively new measure that I know we're going to be talking about later that relies on, and I'll just real simply, relies on this concept of a wasted vote. So a wasted vote is, say, a wasted vote is a vote for any candidate who any vote for above the bare majority needed to win for a winning candidate. So if there's 100 voters in a district, to win, you only need 51 if there's only two parties. So any vote above 51 is considered wasted because you didn't need those votes. A wasted vote would also be any vote for a losing candidate, because if you lose by one vote or 100 votes, you still lost. So it doesn't matter how many people voted for you. So the theory behind this approach is that if a party's drawing up a legislative map. They want to drive up the number of wasted votes for the opposing party so that even no matter how many votes they get, more of them go towards futile causes, either to pad a winner's margin
right.
or towards a loser in a narrow loss.
So you try to pack all the Democrats or all the Republicans right. in quote unquote safe districts.
And minimize your own wasted votes so that you win where you win, you know, you win in narrow margins where possible. You know, we also did a few things like look at, say, the presidential level vote district by district to get a sense of the real base partisan leaning of districts. What we found is, and we applied it just to the state Senate, what we found is that, you know, looking generally speaking over the last 30 years, the state Senate legislative maps, more often than not, with just a few exceptions, favor Republicans, give Republicans an outcome in terms of the actual seats that they win in the Senate that is over and above what a neutral map would give them. But that, generally speaking, it's not enough. That advantage is not enough to overcome, say, Democratic wave elections. And we've had a couple in the last few years. The biggest one was in 08 when President Obama was first running and there was a giant swell of Democratic votes nationally, which washed over in New Hampshire. But in a sort of, you know, your typical election year, say even last year or 2012, the lines are drawn, at least in the Senate, in such a way that Republicans have this sort of this extra boost.
Built-in advantage.
Right.
Because of the way the lines are drawn.
And as Rob indicated, I mean, the thing is, in New Hampshire, it's totally legal. As long as the districts are of roughly the same size, that they're contiguous, and that you don't break up towns, you know, there's nothing fishy about what – this is just what the process yields. And you know, obviously there are some questions about demographic shifts underlying that. But I think, you know, fairly consistently the way the lines in the Senate districts have been drawn will more often than not favor Republicans.
Why was the state Senate, Dan, such a good case study for this?
Well, we wanted to look at either, you know, the legislature, obviously, the Senate and the House. The Senate in New Hampshire is just a 24-member district, 24 districts, 24 elections every year. The House, obviously, 400 members. Many districts elect multiple members. They could elect a Democrat and a Republican. And some towns are actually in multiple districts, maybe one district just covering their town and another multi-member district. That would require to kind of computing power that I'm not sure we or really anyone possesses. But the Senate was relatively clean. And it gives you just a much sharper snapshot of sort of the partisan shift in the state over the last 30 years or so.
Well, and I want to let everybody know there's some great maps and Dan's analysis and some other work by the State of Democracy team on our website, nhpr.org. And when you look at the maps over the last 30 years, you can really see how these districts, some of them have changed dramatically. Again, it's nhpr.org. You can give us a call now with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. We're taking your questions and comments about redistricting here in the Granite State and nationally. And joining us now on the phone is Nick Stephanopoulos. He's an assistant professor at the University of Chicago Law School, a redistricting expert whose research interests include election law and constitutional law. And Nick Stephanopoulos, good to have you. Thanks for your time.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, and it's your work that Dan Barrick referenced earlier, figuring out a different way to figuring out gerrymandering. But Nick, just first, you've written that gerrymandering is at an all-time high. How so?
So we took the metric that's been discussed on the show so far, the efficiency gap, and we calculated the value of the efficiency gap for every map in every year from 1972 to the present. And so that's really the entire modern era, you know, the entire period in which districts have had to comply with the one-person, one-vote requirement. And what we found is that the absolute value of the efficiency gap spikes to an all-time high in the current redistricting cycle. So in 2012 and 2014, we're getting the highest values recorded for the efficiency gap nationwide. And this isn't really an accident. This is a reflection of a deliberate effort on both sides, although in this cycle more on the Republican side than the Democratic side, to craft very efficient, very potent gerrymanders in many states around the country.
So we're going to have to, Nick, just unpack a little bit what you mean by efficiency gap. Let's go through it step by step, if we could, please. So it starts with something you call a wasted vote, which, by the way, goes counter to what we always hear, that every vote counts. What's a wasted vote, Nick?
Yeah, so wasted vote here has a very technical meaning, and it's not meant to say that, you know, voters don't count or their voices shouldn't be heard. So wasted vote is just a vote that doesn't contribute directly to a candidate's victory in a district. And there are two kinds of wasted votes. You can all the votes cast for a losing candidate are wasted because that candidate loses. And in addition, all the candidates cast for a winning candidate, but above the threshold that candidate needed to win, which is 50% plus one, those are wasted as well.
I find that really disheartening, Nick.
It's a product of our system. You know, anytime you have winner-take-all elections, you're going to have a lot of wasted votes because everything switches at that 50% plus one threshold. You know, if you're below it, you lose. If you're above it, you win. And all that matters is whether you're above or below it. And so, you know, huge numbers of wasted votes are a necessary product of our winner-take-all districting system.
Well, and Nick, your analysis also includes something, and this helps explain it too, something called pack and crack. Can you explain that, please?
Yeah, so all of gerrymandering takes place either through one of these two techniques, and usually both of these techniques used together. So cracking is dividing a party's supporters among a bunch of districts where they predictably lose by relatively small margins. And then packing is over-concentrating a party's supporters in just a few districts where they win by overwhelming margins. And so both packing and cracking produce wasted votes. Those wasted votes are surplus votes in the case of packing, and they're lost votes in the case of cracking.
And Dan Barrick, in your analysis of state Senate districts here in New Hampshire, are there some examples that jump out of pack or crack?
Yeah, and you can see it in a couple ways. I mean, one way, as we said, is you can look at the outcome in the presidential level election in those districts as kind of a proxy for partisanship. And you can see that shifting in some districts becoming much more Democratic leaning over the last 12 years or so, or much more Republican. One example is essentially a brand new district that was created in the last round, District 4. None of the towns that are now in District 4 were in that district in the last map, but it essentially created a super Democratic district that includes Dover, which is a very liberal town near the seacoast, with a couple of other left-leaning towns. It's perhaps now the most Democratic-leaning district in the Senate. Another example is, say, the district that sort of centers on Hanover and Lebanon, again, a very liberal part of the state. That district once sort of stretched east to include more moderate, even Republican-leaning parts of the state, towns like New London and I believe even the city of Franklin at one time. It now stretches pretty much just hugs of the Connecticut River Valley, Upper Valley, which, you know, anyone who sort of knows New Hampshire politics knows that's really the most Democratic part of the state. It's now gone from being reliably Democratic to essentially, like, you know, guaranteed Democratic. And you saw that the sort of cracking a little bit in some other districts on the seacoast. District 24, which was once sort of anchored in Portsmouth, again, a very liberal community. Portsmouth was taken out of that district, and in its place were included some more Republican-leaning seacoast communities all the way down to Seabrook. And it went from being a district that reliably elected Democrats for the last 15 years or so to now, for the first time post that redistricting, elected a moderate Republican by a narrow margin. And I think it went from being a fairly safe Democratic district to one that's, you know, kind of a toss-up, slightly leaning Republican. So those are examples sort of both the packing and the cracking that you've seen the map that we now have in play.
So we have both packing and cracking here
yeah.
in New Hampshire.
And some of that's inevitable. I mean, there's no way to draw a totally – I mean, I think either Nick and his work or elsewhere, it's like any map is going to have some measure of wasted vote. Any election, any contested election is going to have some measure of wasted votes. It's just which party has – the higher share of them, that sort of leads you towards this sense of, okay, this map may be heading towards gerrymander territory.
All right, and a lot more to talk about in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, drawing political boundaries, including some new analysis by NHPR of state Senate districts and how they've become less politically diverse. We want you to call in, give us your questions and comments about this at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. With us is Dan Barrick, Senior Policy and Politics Editor at NHPR. Dan and his State of Democracy team have analyzed 30 years of state Senate maps and data. You can go to nhpr.org to see more. Rob Boatwright is also with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at Clark University. He teaches courses on American political behavior, parties, campaigns, and elections. And joining us for a few more minutes is Nick Stephanopoulos, assistant professor at the University of Chicago Law School. He's a redistricting expert. Again, you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. And Nick, Dan Barrick described a couple state Senate districts here in the Granite State where we've seen either pack or crack, again, packing all the voters of a particular party into one area or breaking them up so they have less clout. What stands out as examples of pack and crack nationally, Nick? Are there a couple places where it's really just been horribly obvious?
Yeah, you have a number of purple states where Republicans were in full control of the state government in 2010. And because they had full control right when redistricting took place in the current cycle, they were able to enact really, really favorable pro-Republican maps in those places. So some particular states that come to mind are Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Florida, North Carolina, Ohio, Michigan. Really, when you think about most of the heavily contested swing states in presidential elections, a lot of those states, or maybe I think all of the ones I just mentioned, voted for Obama in 2012 and 2008. But because Republicans controlled those states in 2010, they enacted very extreme gerrymanders in all of those cases.
And Nick, you look back since the early 70s. Are there examples of Democrats stacking the deck? Because, you know, we've heard here in New Hampshire one Democratic state senator say, you know, when Democrats are in charge, we do it too.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, a couple points there. One is that when you look at the overall distribution of the efficiency gap over the last 40 years, it's not at all tilted in a Republican direction. It's a nice bell curve looking distribution featuring about the same number of awful Democratic gerrymanders as it does awful Republican gerrymanders. So where have those bad Democratic gerrymanders been? A lot of them were in the Deep South in the 70s and 80s, so areas where Democrats used to have almost complete control, but obviously now things are different. This cycle, you see some pretty bad pro-Democratic maps in places like Rhode Island, Massachusetts. So again, states where Democrats had control over redistricting and used that control to give themselves a substantial advantage. So, you know, at the current moment in time, we definitely have a larger volume of pro-Republican than pro-Democratic gerrymandering. But that's primarily a function of just which party was in control of redistricting in more states in 2010.
Sure, we had that big Republican Tea Party wave in 2010, and they won control of state houses and Congress, and so they got to control the process. Dan, you wanted to jump in there.
Yeah, I mean, Nick's right about the national distribution between the parties in terms of, you know, quote-unquote bad gerrymandered maps. I mean, in New Hampshire, we found it was by and large in the Republicans' favor, and that's not because of any inherent qualities of the Democratic or Republican parties here in New Hampshire. It's simply because Republicans have always managed to hold the majority in the state house every 10 years when the redistricting process comes around. And you're right. I mean, there are some Democrats who would who would rather who say, you know, this is sort of to the winner go the spoils things. We do the same thing. So that's why there has been a push from some other quarters for this more independent approach to doing it, taking it out of the legislature's hands.
Well, and Rob Boatwright, a question for you. How reasonable is it to expect districts to be more evenly balanced? I mean, we can talk about, you know, lawmakers doing this pack and crack, but where do natural human patterns of social gathering, people wanting to be together, where does that stop and gerrymandering begin? How do you determine that?
Well, this is a point that came up several minutes ago in the conversation. Voters are not distributed evenly, and the current Democratic and Republican coalitions are such that Democratic voters tend to be concentrated in the major cities. So there's the only way in many states, many of the purple states that we've been talking about, to create a map that was, you know, somewhere close to 50-50 would involve drawing some kind of tortured shapes in larger cities. Democrats have done this in the past. If you go back and look at congressional maps for cities like Chicago, for instance, Democrats have been very creative in trying to put a handful of Republican voters into heavily Democratic districts to kind of dilute Republican strength elsewhere. So there's no neutral way to do this, and I think in addition, a couple important things to consider. We've talked about the 2010 election. The nation has also developed this sort of sawtooth pattern where Republicans do much, much better in midterm elections, or at least they have over the past few years. So much of this is an artifact of the 2010 election. The 2020 election will take place in a presidential year where there will be higher Democratic turnout. So we're likely to see very different dynamics in terms of who controls redistricting in the future. And I think finally there's a question of what sort of legislators you want. Well, many of the redistricting plans we've talked about are particularly egregious. A case can be made that safe legislators can actually do a lot of good, right? If you're not worried about your next reelection, you may actually pay more attention to policy, pay more attention to working with the other side. So it's not automatically the case that drawing highly competitive districts is the best way to create a legislature.
So can you figure out, Rob, where birds of a feather flock together stops and, you know, gerrymandering begins? Again, given that people tend to, as you say, Democrats tend to congregate in cities. Here in New Hampshire, you know, Concord's a very Democratic town. Democrats might not feel too comfortable in Alton, which is a very Republican town. So can you even really, Rob, figure out where that stops and gerrymander begins?
I don't think there's a perfect method. Political scientists over the past few decades have tried to come up with various different formulas for how dispersed a district is, all those sorts of things. But there's not really that much consensus. For the most part, redistricting commissions or states that have tried to create additional rules have tried to talk about, say, respecting geographic boundaries, right? Respecting city lines, thinking about natural features, right? If you got a mountain range going right through the district, maybe that's a convenient way to divide things up. But there's no magical way to do this. I think the most important change over the past few years is that the technology we have to do this is far superior to what states had in the 80s and the 90s, even at the time of the 2000 election. So while gerrymandering has been a part of politics since the establishment of the republic, it's now the case that state legislators, and for that matter, citizens sitting at home with a good software package on their computer, can sit down and try to draw districts that are likely to advantage themselves.
Well, and Nick, last question for you. I wonder what you think about that, too. The idea that, you know, is it gerrymandering or is it just people who are of a similar economic status with similar interests tend to live near each other?
So I think there's no question that the, you know, the overall partisan tilt of a map is a function of a lot of things, one of which includes the sort of natural political geography of the state. So if you take a place that has you know, a lot of Democrats concentrated in cities, and you then draw districts paying no consideration to people's electoral behavior, you're likely to end up with a bunch of unintentionally but still quite packed Democratic districts in those cities. That being said, it's not hard to avoid this result if you actually do take electoral performance into account. So, you know, you don't have to draw a circular district that perfectly corresponds to the heavily Democratic city. You can draw a few circular districts that each include parts of the heavily Democratic city and also include parts of the, you know, more Republican suburbs and exurbs around the city. In many places in the country, it's quite possible to design a map that is much, much fairer than the current map and that performs just as well as the current map in terms of criteria like compactness and even respect for county and town boundaries. So, you know, it's clear that political geography makes some difference, especially if you're either trying to exacerbate its effects or if you ignore electoral data altogether. If you consider electoral performance, it's very often possible to design a plan that's fair to both parties and that performs well in terms of traditional criteria. But of course, to do that, you can't ignore electoral data. You have to use it, you know, for good rather than for evil. And that's what, you know, I would recommend to states that want to prevent themselves from ending up unintentionally in a gerrymandered state.
Well, Nick, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's Nick Stephanopoulos, again, assistant professor at the University of Chicago Law School and a nationally known redistricting expert. And Dan, real quick to you, I'd love your sort of New Hampshire analysis of this. Where do people with common interests, where does that stop and gerrymandering begins?
Yeah, I mean, we really
it's hard to measure.
It is. And we try to. So, as you said, you know, we try to look at voting patterns over the last few years and how that shifted geographically. You know, everyone, you know, we know that New Hampshire has definitely become more of a swing state. Democrats are having much more success. You know, the last three presidential elections, Democrats have won. We've elected Democrats to the corner office, you know, almost consistently for the last 20 years, with one exception: Democratic senator, Democratic congresswomen. And yes, there is no doubt when you look at a lot of the new Democratic votes are coming from already established Democratic strongholds, the Upper Valley, the Concord area, Keene, parts of the Seacoast. So it's not really – it's not dispersed evenly across the state. So in some ways, it is hard to tell exactly where the line between, quote-unquote, gerrymandering is and just natural demographic patterns. But at the same time, if you do look at the individual Senate districts – and again, this is just the laboratory in which we tried to explore these questions – the amount of partisanship – between districts is really growing quite starkly. And again, we used the presidential vote as a stand-in for this. We looked at each district and just calculated what the Democratic/Republican presidential vote was for the last four or five presidential elections. As recently as, say, 2000, you know, 48% of New Hampshire as a whole voted for the Republican candidate. And every Senate district was within 10 points of that, you know, 40% Republican up to maybe high 50%. In the most recent election in 2012, that was much wider span. So you had many more extreme Republican-leaning districts and extreme Democratic-leaning districts, meaning there were fewer districts that sort of mirrored the state as a whole and more on this partisan extreme. And some measure of that is no doubt the result of how the lines are being drawn.
Well, while we're talking about that Senate district map that was redrawn in 2010, we're joined now by Peter Bragdon. He's former Senate president and served as a Republican senator from Milford for many years, including that time of redistricting. Senator Bragdon, welcome back to The Exchange.
Laura, thank you very much. Good to be back.
Well, remind us what the balance of power was back in 2010. That was a big year for your party.
Yeah, 2010 was a big Republican election in the Senate. It was 19-5, which I think was a historic high in terms of the degree of split.
What were the guidelines that you had to follow, Senator Bragdon, to get this redistricting process started?
Well, the key guideline to follow, once we receive the data, and there's a few other things that have to happen, but once you receive the census data, the key thing that drives the process is population. And for at least for state legislative redistricting, my recollection is that if your plan had a deviation of less than 10%, in other words, the ideal population for a district is about 55,000. So as long as the differences between those districts are no more than 10% in the aggregate, then the plan would be deemed to be have presumption of constitutionality, and somebody would have to prove that it was really problematic. If you went past 10%, then it was kind of the tables were flipped at that point, and there was a likelihood there was a problem that you would have to defend. So we came in with the districts that existed at the time because of population shifts were close to 20% outside of the deviation was close to 20%. So our goal was to bring it down to a constitutional level of less than 10%. But population wasn't a litmus test. It was a key factor. But I think as your folks have been talking about this morning, there are things that factor in, including, you know, what are communities of interest. The North Country, for instance, wanted to be able to stay together on the united front and not be split up into a number of smaller things. So you have issues like that. Ironically, I could build a district that was ideal, exactly 54,853 people, that stretched from Pittsburgh down to Madbury, knocking basically at the door of the seacoast. It would take a senator over 3 hours to drive from one end of that district to the other, excluding the time, the 2 hours they'd have to spend traveling to Concord on a different route. So if you just went on population, you'd cause a number of issues in New Hampshire with the citizen legislature.
Communities of interest. So people told you, Senator Bragdon, that, you know, please don't split us up. Please do your best.
Yes. And it ranged from, I recall, large areas like the North Country, where if at that point Senator Gallas was the senator from Berlin, and if he had to travel down 3 hours every way to Madbury and then 2.5 hours to the State House, he could not effectively represent the North Country. So North Country people were saying, please, keep us together. It ranged from that to the smaller level of towns, and in my district, I think of the towns of Peterborough and Sharon, which share schools, share police, are just, adjoined at the hip, basically. And, you want to try and save those communities if you can. And the Senate plan, I know we did because I was keeping an eye out for that on my own. But
well, and Senator Bragdon, we're hearing this morning from our State of Democracy team that this Senate map over the years, especially in 2010, has given an advantage to Republican candidates, even as New Hampshire has become more of a so-called purple state, voting for Democrats for president and often in congressional elections. How fair do you think the maps were that you and your colleagues came up with?
Oh, I think they're very fair. I did get a chance to look at the report, and I have a math computer science background, so I love geeky things like that. Anyway.
Lots of fun maps, NHPR.org.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's a great story. But I do think it makes the assumption that the state Senate races, the 24 of them, should reflect the statewide results, and that's not necessarily the case. If all 24 races had equally known and equally financed candidates running against each other with equal work ethic, then it could be the case that it should track exactly what the statewide results are. But you have a number of things working against that. I can get to that after the break if you want.
Well, yeah, Senator Bragdon, hang on. I'll let you finish that, and I have one more question for you about your thoughts on this idea of an independent commission. So hold on. Stay with us. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, drawing political lines, including some new analysis by NHPR of New Hampshire state Senate districts. Give us a call. Your questions, comments, thoughts about this process, how it works, whether it could work better, are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Dan Barrick's here, Senior Policy and Politics Editor at NHPR. Rob Boatwright joins us from Massachusetts. He's an associate professor of political science at Clark University. And joining us for a few more minutes is Peter Bragdon, former Senate president and Republican from Milford, talking about when he was in the state Senate at the last redistricting. And Senator Bragdon, go ahead. You wanted to finish up there, kind of taking issue with the assertion that the maps drawn in 2010 that you were involved with were unfair.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say I'm taking a big issue with it, but I think in part because of the small size of the Senate, you know, if you have one or two seats that are kind of unique for some reason, that skews the results a little bit as well. And I think in particular of Democrats that do incumbent Democrats that do well in Republican districts and incumbent Republicans that do well in Democratic-leaning districts. And back in 2010, Senator D'Alessandro's district was one that leaned Republican. And then for Senators O'Dell and Gallus, they were in districts that leaned Democrat. But they were incumbent. They were well-liked. They did a lot of work for their communities. And I think at these state races, that's a lot of what drives things is how the senator relates with their community. So you have some examples there of people who are going to defy the odds just because people know them, people like them, and they're less concerned about their party affiliation. So I think it's just a caution that assuming that the Senate districts act the same way as statewide races where there's less of a personal connection, I think can affect things. If we had 50 or 100 Senate districts, then those things would probably work their way out through the details. But when there's only 24, if you get a move of one or two in either direction because of incumbency, you know, that's something that can make things look a little worse than maybe they are.
One last question for you, Senator Bragdon, please. In a handful of states, as I'm sure you know, redistricting has been handed over to independent commissions. So taking the power to redraw those lines from state lawmakers to these outside groups, how do you feel about that idea for New Hampshire?
Well, it sounds like one of those ideas that sounds good at first. You know, let's take politics out of redistricting. But then when you get down to details, you end up saying, oh, wait, we just put politics back in. So the independent commission bills that I've seen in the past all involve people appointed by the governor and the speaker and the minority leader in the House and the president and the minority leader in the Senate. It's still all political appointees. And then per the New Hampshire Constitution, that plan has to come back to the Senate and House for approval. And so you put it back into whatever political atmosphere there might be that good or bad. So I haven't seen a lot of things there that really tell me it's going to change the system other than add a layer of bureaucracy. And really, there's only about a two-month window to put together a redistricting plan because you have to wait until the cities redraw their ward boundaries in November of 2011. You have to have a bill ready in January of 2012. So to add yet another layer of bureaucracy on top of it, all of whom are basically political appointees, doesn't seem to me to really solve the problem, if there is a problem.
Well, Peter Bragdon, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Laura. Good to talk to you.
That's Peter Bragdon, former Senate president and represented Milford in the state Senate for many years. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Rob Boatwright, Dan Barrick, let's go to our listeners. Jim joins us from Manchester. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks for having me on. Just two thoughts. The first one is that in Manchester, where I live, I think there has been a negative effect in having, you know, our senators representing one or two of the surrounding towns and then throwing in a couple of wards from Manchester to represent that as well. So Manchester is no longer represented with one voice in the city of in Concord because it's now the representatives represented, not really the city of Manchester, but mostly the surrounding town with a couple of wards thrown in. So I think that's been negative for the largest city in the state. The second observation I would like to make and ask a question about is, I think some of the effects of the most egregious gerrymandering might be mitigated by multi-seat seat constituencies. So if you stop the one past first past the post, then you have, you know, three seat constituencies, for instance, where a constituency is electing three people, and therefore you're going to end up with, in this case, perhaps one Republican, one Democrat, and the third seat becomes the one that is up.
Jim, let's talk about Manchester, and it gets to Dan Barrick, what Peter Bragdon talked about, communities of interest. In 2010, some people came to Senator Bragdon and said, hey, don't split us up.
Right. And the call is right. I mean, I think right now there's three Senate districts out of the 24 that include some piece of Manchester and a few suburban towns. In some respect, I mean, you couldn't have just one Manchester seat for the very reasons that that Senator Bragdon laid out.
Too many people.
Too many people. You know, you've got 110,000 people living in Manchester. Districts can't be more than 55,000. But I think on the flip side, you could say so the caller's concern is that, you know, representatives, senators from Manchester who represent Manchester also have to keep in mind suburban interests, which may or may not align with what the city residents need. But I know that in some years you've had as many as three senators in the Senate who actually live in the city of Manchester, which is an advantage that, you know, no other town, no other community would really ever have. Similarly, Nashua is another case where there are two districts that sort of contain Nashua. And one that we looked at closely in our work is District 12, which has traditionally included a big chunk of Nashua and a few of its western suburbs. In the most recent round of redistricting, that went from a district that was predominantly Nashua, 70% plus of the voters lived in Nashua, the remaining 30% or so lived in the suburbs, to, under the current map, actually slightly more, slightly less than half of the district included Nashua. So it went from and so they took out some of the Nashua parts of the district and included more suburban towns, which, surprise, surprise, tended to lean Republican. Nashua tends to lean Democratic. So it went from a majority Nashua district and a couple suburbs to a slightly majority suburban district with a little bit of Nashua. So you can see how, you know, moving those lines around can have a big impact on the overall complexion of the district.
So that community of interest got broken up.
Well, I'm not sure I could draw that conclusion, but you know, you can change by including more or less of a city versus its suburbs. It may be Nashua and its suburbs may be a community of interest by some definitions, but by others, not really.
Well, Jim, thank you for the call. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. And got a couple emails here I'd like to share with you, gentlemen. And Rob, Nancy from Durham writes, what would an independent commission look like? Who would be on it and who would choose its members? We talked about this a little bit with Senator Bragdon, but other states have done this, Rob. Not a lot, but a few.
So there are several states that have experimented with this. They all have different rules. For the most part, the people pointed to commissions have to be people who don't have any ties to sitting legislators. There's also an effort to make them bipartisan, to create some sort of balance in the commission. And then in many cases, the people on these commissions are required to have a certain amount of training, right? These are the various standards that people have talked about. They're very much a work in progress. In some states, they've turned out quite well. Iowa, for instance, likes to talk about their nonpartisan commission. However, Iowa is a somewhat unique state in that the population is kind of evenly distributed around the state, and the sorts of differences we see between urban and rural areas in other states are not quite as present in Iowa. New Jersey has done this for a number of years. It's kind of famously been a disaster in New Jersey because every year the commission basically seeks to protect the incumbents, so New Jersey elections wind up being relatively uncompetitive. California instituted a commission after the 2010 election, and that commission kind of interestingly was told to disregard incumbency, and they came up with some very interesting districts, but California also instituted a top two primary in the same election, so it's been challenging in many instances to determine whether changes in the legislature we've seen there have been an effect of redistricting or the new primary system.
So, Rob, it sounds like some of these states, half a dozen or so that have tried this, have had some limited success.
They have, but again, it's hard to separate out effects of those states from what went on the commission, and it also depends on how you define success. I think one of the comments that Peter Bragdon emphasized that I think I agree with, for the most part, legislators, you know, they're competent people. They know what they are doing, and most of the decisions they have to make don't necessarily have to do with party, but with respecting the communities that are already in your district. So to kind of put this in the framework of what an individual legislator might be thinking, there are probably many districts in New Hampshire that have long-running problems, right? A waste disposal problem, let's say a reservoir or something else that requires the attention of a legislator. And you've got somebody who's dealt with this problem for 6, 8, 10 years, really knows the concerns of the local residents, really, really knows what needs to be done. Now, you want to respect that, right? You want to keep that person in charge of that particular problem that they've been dealt with. You want to, you want to reward expertise. So that's the sort of thing that can be very, very tricky for a some sort of nonpartisan commission to really understand, but a legislature can think about that.
Well,
so,
Nancy,
you know, for the most part, this is a litmus test, right? What do we think of our legislators? Do we trust them to...
especially in a small state like New Hampshire, where you do have the opportunity to get to know people a little bit. Nancy, thank you for the email. Let's go back to the calls, and Perry joins us from Merrimack. Hi, Perry. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up a point that a previous caller had mentioned, and it wasn't really discussed, is... And I forgot what the exact system he identified was, but moving past first past the post and talking about where the way he described it, there was, you know, you would have each district. The districts might be a little bit bigger, but they would have three legislatures or three seats to elect. And it's possible one could be, and it would allow more independent parties and more third parties to come. So I just wanted your guest to speak more to that.
Okay. Perry, thank you very much for calling in. Dan, can you jump in there?
I've heard of this. I mean, it's not something that's been proposed even in the discussions of those who'd like to reform our current system. I think it would – I mean, there's been enough pushback and trouble to even change the system from how it's existed for decades. Something like that might seem a little bit, too much to swallow at once. And, you know, there has been – as we mentioned, the House, the New Hampshire House with 400 members has a much more complicated district system, which, as we said, includes lots of multi-member districts where, you know, if you've gone and voted, chances are you've got – it says, like, choose 4 of 12. So and also many towns are in multiple districts where they're electing – they are a member of something what the caller described, one representative for their one town, say the town of Warner. But then Warner also is in a 3-town district that elects 3 members. So you've got this and that has been a big problem. I mean, both politically and legally, it's led to court cases and constitutional amendment that passed about a decade ago. I think for some people that adds a layer of complexity that it just makes it harder for the average voter to just even understand, okay, who's representing me? Where, you know, where do I fit into this map? So,
yeah, no wonder you chose the state Senate, because the House is a whole nother can of worms, so to say. Jerry, thank you very much for the call. Here's an email from Jordan in Auburn who says, I've said it before, I'll say it again. With the obvious exception along state borders, districts need to be grid-based, Jordan says, only changing based on the amount of squares based on the population count. Both at the state and federal level, we'd still have polarized politics and corrupting money in the system, but we'd see a lot more balance and truly competitive elections with more of the people's will, Jordan says, instead of politicians and corporate will. Jordan, thank you for the email. I love your thoughts, Rob, on this. You know, we're talking about numbers and maps, but it really kind of boils down to politics and what Congress is able to get done and what it isn't able to get done.
The grid-based notion, people toss this around, right? It looks nice on paper. But natural borders don't follow those sorts of lines. City borders don't follow those sorts of lines. So how the map looks really, it's one consideration, but it's not necessarily the most important one.
All right. Thank you for that email, Jordan. Here's another one from Brian. He says, gerrymandering is just one issue regarding voting and campaign finance reforms that the New Hampshire House and Senate have failed to fix this past term. Brian says voters are frustrated and angry that their interests are not being fairly represented, and as witnessed in the Trump and Sanders campaigns, are increasingly turning their backs on the party structure, which supports manipulation of redistricting and sleazy campaign funding. So that's from Brian. Here's another one from Brendan, who says the country is increasingly young, urban, and non-white. Political parties in particular can keep suppressing votes and playing games with the rules, or they could change their platform to actually attract voters honestly. Brendan, thank you for that one. And let's take one more call, gentlemen. This is Daniel in Dover. Go ahead, Daniel. You're on the air. And I guess we lost Daniel there. Daniel, I hope to hear from you again another day. Don't bother calling back because we've run out of time. I did want to ask you one last question, Rob Boatwright. So we won't be in another census year for another 4 years till 2020. How much change do you expect to see between now and then, Rob?
How much change in...
In terms of how states approach this redistricting process. Are we going to have a lot of talk and no action, or will we see big changes across the country by the time 2020 rolls around?
I don't know that we'll see big changes, but the big difference, people move around. So, of course, maps become less accurate as the decade goes on. But citizens have the ability to learn much more about the process than was ever the case in the past. Certainly after the 2010 election, a number of universities, including my own, made software available to the students, the general public. And it's very easy for anyone to sit down and try to figure out how they might do this sort of stuff. And, of course, once you've done that, you can send that to your legislator, right? You can say, hey, I've come up with this idea for how maps work. So I think citizens have the ability to be much more involved in the process. We can't guarantee that legislators are going to pay attention to them, but many legislators will, and I think citizens can at least keep closer tabs on what's going on.
We've got the tools now with all the maps and so forth. Go ahead, Dan, real quick.
Well, I mean, as you said, 2020, a few years away, it's going to be a presidential year. 2010 was obviously the last time it was the Tea Party year. I mean, who would have predicted 5 years before that 2010 would see a year of unprecedented Republican wins fueled by voter outrage? I mean, to understand what the next round of redistricting will look like, you kind of have to know what the political climate will be in 2020. I mean, I don't know what the political climate is going to be next month. So
next week.
Right. So it's really hard to say, although I imagine with the presidential year, it will be increasingly charged.
All right. We will end it there. Both of you, thank you very much for being with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.